Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 18th of November. Afghanistan is what we talk about this hour of the program, and our guest has said, we went in, we drove the Taliban out, we didn't pursue them, we didn't keep them from coming back. We kind of glazed over in our vision relating to that part of the world and focused on Iraq when we should have understood that the biggest threat to us lay along that border in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Professor Thomas Gutierrez is our guest this hour, Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and the University of Nebraska Medical Center and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska. He lived and worked for nearly 10 years in Afghanistan, served as a Peace Corps volunteer, a Fulbright Fellow, and Executive Director of the Fulbright Foundation. He also coached the Afghan national basketball team, was selected to serve as Senior Political Affairs Officer on the UN to the peacekeeping mission to Afghanistan in 96-97, and he has testified on various topics related to Afghanistan, U.S.-Pakistani relations, international terrorism, and human rights before hearings of various United States governmental bodies and also in England, in France, and for the UN Select Committee on Human Rights. Our phone number as we talk about Afghanistan, which will be a subject that President-elect Barack Obama will have to deal with very soon, is 800-486-8655. That's the number that you should call to be part of our conversation. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Thomas Gutierrez, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Good. Well, the new president's going to have a lot to deal with when it comes to Afghanistan. Can you give me some kind of thumbnail historical sketch of what in the world has happened there in the last 7 years?
We started out well by joining with the Afghans who were as eager to get the combination of Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, drug lords, and the Pakistani military out of their country as we were to get those people who attacked us on 9/11. And by the end of the year, we had essentially driven that combination, aggregation of opposing forces, at least to the border of Pakistan, and had worked with the international community and the Afghans towards putting together an interim government. Unfortunately, from that point on, our record, particularly the United States record, became a bit spotty. We outsourced the pursuit of Osama bin Laden and his colleagues and others to groups instead of going after them ourselves, and they slipped away. And then we also outsourced the reconstruction of Afghanistan, the rebuilding of a nation that had been, you know, in a state of constant violence and near warfare for about three decades. To an approach that I refer to as the donor conference approach. We call donor conferences to cities with around the world, like Tokyo or London or Berlin or Rome, and nations pledge money to help Afghanistan. Sometimes those who pledge don't always deliver on time, have their own accountability issues within their own governments, and also have their own agendas. So instead of doing a kind of Marshall Plan approach to Afghanistan, we had a kind of piecemeal approach. Some things got done, and very successfully so. There were the Afghans went about the process of constitution writing and elections, and they did a very good job. I think everybody gives them great credit for the way that process went and those that helped them as well. We built some roads to help improve the infrastructure. We've been working to rebuild the Afghan National Army and the police, but these things have gone along in spotty ways, mainly because of a rather uncoordinated approach. I think from the beginning, we had people like Vice President Cheney and Assistant Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz and others saying that We weren't about nation building or reconstruction. Then their focus went towards Iraq and Afghanistan, though we continued to provide help to it, was not our primary focus. And mm-hmm. I think now it's showing, because what has happened is that the forces that we left off the hook, so to speak, in late 2001 and early 2002 now have reconstituted themselves in the stateless areas of Pakistan, the tribal agency areas along the border with Afghanistan. And that's, the source of great concern now in terms of security in Afghanistan. So that's the thumbnail, all right?
Right. Thank you. It was very well done. One of the decisions, much has been made at the press of this, facing Barack Obama will be whether or not to negotiate with a resurgent Taliban. Tell me, how strong is the Taliban right now? And can you negotiate with factions of this organization or not?
Well, we tend to lump the term, we let many groups into this term Taliban. And in fact, there are the original Taliban around who congregated around Mullah Muhammad Omar and were active in Afghanistan, controlling much of the country from 1996 until 2001. But the ones that I think Karzai and others talk about are those who aren't really so much committed to that particular movement or to any alliance with Al-Qaeda or the Pakistani military intelligence or the drug lords, but are really more concerned about their own role in a future Afghanistan, and they get kind of lumped into this, or also individuals and groups in areas where growing poppies are their only means of being able to sustain themselves and their families, and so they're all lumped together. I think that there are individuals like that and groups like that in various regions, particularly along the border area with Pakistan, that need to be brought into the Afghan political spectrum. And one must remember that historically, in Afghanistan, the certain groups of the Pashtuns of Afghanistan, most notably the Ghilzai, but others as well, who are not Durrani Pashtuns, and I know this is starting to get a little technical with these names, but they have never felt like they were fully incorporated into the political process of the past, and that's just because they were not a member of the predominant strain of Pashtun that held the royal monarchy or the capital, although they were incorporated into development programs and were able to run for parliament and things of that nature during the period of the 60s and 70s. But anyhow, they've never felt as much a part of the government. There are also groups, by the way, that are not engaged in any way with the Taliban, who feel the same thing. And that's the challenge before the Karzai government, is to reach out and make people feel like they're connected to the central government in Kabul. And so the approach of Karzai and others who suggest maybe talking and negotiating with some of these groups, I think is valid. And but there are some that, if indeed there's an attempt to bring them within some kind of broader Afghan political spectrum, by doing so, it would create greater problems than it would present solutions, because of the past, the ethnic cleansing that Mullah Muhammad Omar and others, engaged in when they were trying to gain control over the whole of the country before that period that ended their reign following 9/11.
Let's talk about the number of troops, U.S. troops specifically, that are in the country right now, and calls from U.S. commanders, calls from the president-elect for an increase. The commanders have said maybe 20,000 troops to improve security. Do we need to send more troops to improve security? What would they do?
Well, we do need to send more right at this time. There are some people who suggest that this is not the appropriate approach, and they say that over a long term, the Afghans tend to resent the presence of foreign troops on their soil. That is historically correct, but every time that has been historically correct, it's because of the fact that the foreign troops came in invading and occupied Afghanistan against the Afghans' wishes. Our presence right now, if the Afghans have a major complaint, is that we're not there enough. And we've got to remember that Afghanistan, on 9/11 and the period immediately after that, was a country in totally at a loss for its infrastructure, its brain trust, and was totally in a position of being unable to help its own self reconstruct. And it didn't get the Marshall Plan. And when you go through 30 years of constant violence and warfare, it is, devastating. And so there was no military or police force that one could have called into use, like the case in Iraq, where they had been dismissed. There was not such a thing in Afghanistan anymore. And so now we're building the Afghan military. And until that process is complete, there's going to be a need for, an appropriate number of troops to counter these groups that move from the stateless areas in Pakistan along the Afghan border into Afghanistan. And they have refuge in Pakistan, and you don't need to have a lot of them to do terrorist work. And terrorism creates a lot of intimidation and has a lot more influence and power than numbers. And so we need to be able to counter that kind of thing, and we need more troops from the U.S. and from NATO.
There aren't too many people in this country, Tom, who know this country, Afghanistan, as well as you do. You were a Peace Corps volunteer, invaluable experience in all the years you've spent in Afghanistan. I'm wondering if you've been asked to advise the current administration. Who are they bringing in to advise them, and are you among those people?
The upcoming administration,
right,
you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Not yet. I did something informally this past week, but in D.C., but it wasn't directly engaged with that. But I expect that the new administration will consult with individuals who have had this, some kind of experience. I appreciate your not mentioning my age and the fact that the reason I'm I had such a long history with Afghanistan is because it's long, and but there are advantages to having seen Afghanistan.
Sure.
in the period in the 60s and 70s when the Afghans were at peace with themselves and at peace with the world and were engaged in their own nation building efforts, and one has a different view of the Afghan capacity for dealing with themselves from that kind of perspective. And so I hope we're, those of us who are still around doing these kinds of things are brought into the mix. We were doing that at the very early periods after 9/11, but actually ran afoul of our current administration, largely because we were voicing praise for the fact that we went in and finally targeted the threats to the U.S., because we hadn't done that either under the Clinton administration or the early months of the Bush administration until we were attacked. But then it was obvious that the eyes of those who were making the foreign policy decisions in our government were glazing over regarding Afghanistan when people were talking about nation building and reconstruction. We're looking towards Iraq. And I think that group kept its own counsel very close to itself and went about its own way, which I think was unfortunate for our own nation's interests as well as the Afghans.
to your phone calls. Our lines are all filled, so we'll start taking calls for Dean Thomas Gutierrez, Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and the Medical Center, and is director he is of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Started his association with Afghanistan as a Peace Corps volunteer. He's worked as a Fulbright Fellow, Executive Director of the Fulbright Foundation, Senior Political Affairs Officer on the United Nations peacekeeping mission to Afghanistan in 96-97, and speaks the languages of the country and is a valuable resource. We will take your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. If you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll talk with two of the authors of Closed Minds, Politics and Ideology in American Universities. Our guests have studied the makeup of the faculty at esteemed universities all over the country, and they say if there has been a conspiracy among liberal faculty members to influence students, they've done a pretty bad job. All right, to your phone calls now. Let's start with Virginia from Janesville. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. I first of all, I like when he gets technical, and he shouldn't be worried about that at all. We need to know a lot more specifics than we do know. But as a woman, this war was sold to me because of what the Taliban did to women. And there was extreme publicity about that when we first got into Afghanistan. And I know that Condi Rice set up 17 regional women's centers, had many task forces dealing with economic development for women, brought Afghani women here, sent U.S. advisors there. In fact, some of us think that those regional women's centers are underground battered women's shelters. I know that there was women's police forces being set up and arming women and training them. And in the last couple years, that all fell apart. This journalist got life, almost death, for passing out papers on the equality of women. Other women are now being persecuted, acid thrown in schoolgirls' faces. And I want to know, first of all, how did that effort all collapse? And second of all, what he thinks will be Obama's position on secularization and the working for women's rights in Afghanistan.
Thank you, Virginia.
Well, first of all, let me say that this is a very important question, and one that we have been involved with both directly and indirectly at the Center for Afghanistan Studies. We currently are engaged in a number of teacher training programs, primarily in-service teacher training programs, that have since the beginning of 2002 trained over 8,100 teachers in Afghanistan, and more than 80% of them are female. So we're bringing them back. We have brought them back into the workplace. And so we have been observing some of the things which the caller mentioned, that there was a period initially when there was a lot of concerted effort to improve the conditions for females in Afghanistan, and those things progressed largely unchallenged. They are challenged now, largely again by fundamentalist groups, as well as the parts of the combined neo-Taliban aggregation that got away at the end of 2001. And they do target some of these very teachers that we're training and that other programs are engaged in. There are many other programs that have made the training of females in a variety of areas, as well as the providing of programs that have a human rights and civil rights orientation to them, that are very active still in Afghanistan. So the whole thing isn't collapsed, and there are a lot of things that are happening, some of them perhaps not as with as much fanfare as some of the things that accompany an effort by a Secretary of State or something of that nature. But there have been setbacks, and those setbacks have involved some of our teachers being threatened, and that if they continued teaching, they would, you know, their families would be attacked and things of this nature. I think, first of all, that the influence of females in Afghanistan grows with each day, really, and it's a long struggle. And there are many people in Afghanistan, particularly many fathers, who are feel very favorably about their daughters being able to participate in life just as much as their sons. Not everyone, obviously, but this is an incremental kind of progress. I think that the future administration, the Obama administration, if it better coordinates America's leadership in the whole overall reconstruction effort in Afghanistan, will obviously find itself dealing with these issues. And I think it will take the right approach, which is to do more to empower, improve the capacity of women to participate actively in their society. Right now, in the parliament of Afghanistan, there's a very high percentage of female, members. Comparatively, it's high, even with Western parliamentary bodies. And so the new constitution guarantees that percentage. And so there are many things that are happening that are cause for concern, but there are also many things that are happening that, the women themselves are being adamant about, a continuation. And to his credit, Hamid Karzai has always been an advocate for the role of females participating actively in the public life of Afghanistan. And when I lived there in the 60s and 70s, 60% of the Afghan teaching cadre were female, and more than 50% of the employees in the government offices in Kabul were female. So there is a history. And there are, positive signs right now, even with those that we read about. And those things that we read about, of course, the negative things are going to come to the news more quickly than those things that have a more positive element to them.
Thanks, Virginia, very much for the call. You mentioned, before we go back to phone calls, Secretary of State and strong presence in that country and others in the world. I know earlier in November, you said that Obama should pick Hagel as Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, or National Security Advisor. Do you still feel that way? And we'll have to ask your thoughts about Senator Clinton as well in serving in this capacity.
Well, I feel very strongly about Senator Hagel. First of all, I know him well. He's from Nebraska and an individual I knew before he was even senator. But I know of no other elected official in either the House or the Senate who is more informed, has done more to speak out about what he felt was the important foreign policy directions that our country should be taking, even when this brought him in at odds with his own party and a president from his own party, as has been the case these last 7 years. And I think that he would be a very excellent Secretary of State or Defense, or maybe the head of the CIA or a National Security Advisor, because I have such confidence in his knowledge of foreign affairs, particularly of that part of the world, in that part of the world which is so critical to our future. So, of course, it's up to President Obama to make that choice, and so we'll see where that goes. But he has mentioned that he would like to employs some Republicans in his cabinet, so I thought this would be a pretty good one, and I had a public forum, and I took advantage, and, and I mentioned it.
But, all right.
And in terms of Senator Clinton, I know that Obama is thinking about the book by Doris Kearns Goodwin called A Team of Rivals, which chronicles Abraham Lincoln's choosing of his cabinet, and he took all of those people who ran against him for president and brought him into the cabinet, and because he thought they were the strongest people. So, in asking or thinking about or suggesting, Hillary Clinton as a potential Secretary of State or something of that nature, I think Obama, who has often referred to this book as having recently read it, is probably doing that. My own thought is that the president, the role of Bill Clinton and his travels and gaining salary and also contributions to his foundation around the world may create a potential issue that would have to be addressed before choosing somebody like Senator Clinton for that role. I would prefer to see her as Attorney General, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she would make a remarkable Attorney General, and or maybe the first choice of the president-elect when he had an opportunity for somebody on the Supreme Court.
Let's go to Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. My question would be along the following line. It would seem to me that when we look to stabilize a country, let's say Afghanistan, what we're looking for is to reach some sort of economic stability for that country. And I question, being poppy, such a large factor in what I can imagine the Afghan economy. And I draw parallels, let's say, to South America, to Peru, Bolivia, Colombia, with the coca problem, where we have failed to eradicate it. How are we going to address that problem in Afghanistan?
Well, that's the $64 million question always, because it is, as you suggest, Michael, the a very, very large part of the gross national product of Afghanistan. Contrast that to the way it was in the time that I lived in Afghanistan in the 60s and 70s. Afghanistan was not an opium poppy exporting nation at all. In fact, one didn't find fields of opium poppies growing anywhere in Afghanistan. Afghanistan exported pomegranates and pistachios, walnuts, almonds, raisins, grapes, and other such cash crops that went out to places like India and Pakistan and the Persian Gulf. And as long as the opium poppy is the primary cash crop in Afghanistan, it's going to be a major problem, not only for those trying to help Afghanistan bring about stability in the country, but also for the Afghans themselves. It's just not an industry that provides for a normal progression to nation state building. And the real serious problem about that is that the opium poppy is about the easiest crop to grow anywhere. It has generally between 2.5 to 3 seasons in every year. The only thing you really need is manure, and Afghanistan is a country where there's a lot of animal husbandry, so there's a lot of manure, and doesn't need as much water as most other crops. And it's a very hardy plant. So it has returns higher than wheat and most of the common other crops that would be grown in the areas where opium poppies are being grown. So what do? Well, you can't replace opium poppies with wheat or rice. You've got to come up with something that is more oriented towards a total economy change. And you have to provide employment opportunities for members of those families that are dependent upon opium poppy revenues. So while maybe one or two brothers might be working on the growing of wheat in the areas where there had been opium poppies being grown. Other members of the family, brothers, cousins, might be trained as mechanics or plumbers or electricians to work on the many construction programs that Afghanistan needs to rebuild itself, and for which right now, international workers, Indians and Pakistanis, are being imported into Afghanistan. It would be better for Afghanistan to not have the reconstruction proceed on such a rapid pace, in other words, dictated by a calendar that wants to have a spin for results going on there, than to have a calendar that would incorporate the training of Afghans. Might be slower in the long term, but might be more productive to the Afghan economy in the long term. So you have to change the economy. You can't just change the crop. There are ways to alter the production in the crops, particularly by perhaps planting orchards, because orchards, if they're planted within the area where one is growing opium poppies, eventually as the trees blossom and bloom, they provide too much shade so that opium poppies can be then phased out. So it would be a phasing out approach, but one that has a phasing in of revenue-producing crops, that the Afghans themselves would have all of their own control over, rather than being dependent upon the international drug cartels. It's a complicated approach. The question that Michael asked is a very, very pertinent one, and it's one that we have not yet, with our allies, come together on an agreed-upon approach. And as a result, like many of the other things that we are trying to do, due to the lack of coordination, there's kind of a gridlock in programmatic facilitation or implementation, and things aren't proceeding perhaps as appropriately as mm-hmm. they should.
I heard somewhere, and it stuck in my mind, Tom, that the amount of opium that's being produced now in Afghanistan is triple what it was 7 years ago. Is that a figure that rings true to you?
Well, that's always hard to substantiate, but it is increased. I mean, there's no question that, it's somewhere in the high 80s or low 90s of the world's total production.
Oh, my gosh, really?
Oh, yes. And interestingly enough, by the way, the product that is produced in Afghanistan doesn't really reach the U.S., but is the primary customers are European and Eurasian. But of course, what that does is it reduces the pressures on the sources that might go to the United States. They can focus on the U.S. They don't have to focus on those other parts of the world. So it adds to a total worldwide production level, and that's a very serious a percentage. But if you just calculate and think about that, you have to understand that it's substantial in terms of the agriculture in Afghanistan. So if you just fly over and wipe out the poppies, what you do is you bring so much of the Afghan population into a dependent mode, because they will no longer have any means of providing for themselves, and you risk the danger also of poisoning or turning toxic the soils. Mm. So it's best to do these things in an incremental way in which Afghans are incorporated in the process themselves. And it's my solid belief that Afghans would prefer not to be poppy farmers, but they need to have alternative economies. And the fact is that the Afghan farmer is at the very bottom of that drug chain. Doesn't get all that much. Each layer in the chain gets more of the profits and the monies the higher the layer goes, and it's the person at the bottom of that chain of producers that gets the lowest amount.
Afghanistan is our topic this hour. Tom Gutierrez is our guest. He is Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and also the medical center there, director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at UNO. He worked in Afghanistan, lived there for 10 years, was a Peace Corps volunteer, a Fulbright Fellow, executive director of the Fulbright Foundation, and also coach of the Afghan national basketball team. He's done all kinds of work since then on peacekeeping missions to Afghanistan and Fulbright programs in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Norway, France, India, Nepal, and Germany. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Did I give you the number? It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now, we go to Jeff from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks. The CIA has this 65-year-old history from the end of World War II on as the major player in the world's distribution of heroin, starting with the reestablishment of the Sicilian Mafia and their role in the worldwide network after Mussolini had smashed them, and they ran away to New York and New Jersey, and they were gathered up and brought back and reestablished through the experience in the Golden Triangle, when the CIA airline Air America was flying the stuff out. And if there's a huge a poppy crop in Afghanistan now, I wonder how we factor in Hamid Karzai's relationship with both Big Oil and the CIA for any hope of weaning that nation of drugs. Secondly, I remember, and we're having a visit here from the Revolutionary Women of Afghanistan, and they were seemingly out in front at the original Loya Jirga, and I wonder why they were sidelined and why they were marginalized and who was responsible for that, because you can have all the incremental growth in women's freedom that you want to talk about, but so long as the powers that be are like warlords like Karzai, he may talk about women, but beyond their sort of surface participation, you need more specifics, more specific action, as the previous caller said.
Tom.
Well, first of all, the important thing to remember about Afghanistan now is that it has a constitution, it has a parliament, and there are Afghan women who were elected to that parliament. I think 29% of the population of the lower house in Afghanistan is female, so they haven't just been shunted aside. And in fact, Karzai was one of the most aggressive promoters of that particular development. So, these things take time. Nobody likes to hear that if they're on the outside of a situation. But in a country that over 30 years moved to the right in terms of its religious politics. When I lived there in the 60s and 70s, Afghanistan wasn't a country where fundamentalism was really at all evident. It was a conservative country, perhaps something like the Bible Belt in the United States, but it wasn't fundamentalist. But fundamentalism crept in, particularly among those Afghans who went to the refugee camps in Pakistan and came under the influence of Wahhabi supported madrasas. And so now people come back into Afghanistan from that kind of religious and political experience, and it's hard to transform their thinking. But the thing that does that, of course, is successful development programming, which involves those people who are going to be leading the country in the future, and they have to be female as well as male. And as I indicated in response to a call from an earlier caller, there are many Afghan females, very visible in the streets today, going about their professional lives, and and certainly a totally different kind of thing that one once saw during the period when the Taliban were in control, when the civil war was going on in Afghanistan. And it's not what it should be, and it doesn't even approximate yet the degree to which Afghan females, I think, felt more free to participate in their society during these 60s and 70s. But the fact is that it's a heck of a lot better than it was, you know, at the beginning of this decade. And it takes time, and that time is bringing more and more vocal content from the females active in society, and they have probably, including people from RAWA, the revolutionary organization, which was mentioned by the caller. These people have all been speaking out. They need to continue to do that. It took a long time in our own society to bring about the female suffrage, and so I think we need to do all we can. I think the new administration needs to do all it can to help females gain professional and personal satisfaction in their own society. Relating to the question about the poppies, I think I addressed that in the response to the previous caller.
Let's talk a little bit about these news reports that surfaced yesterday, this offer from Karzai of safe passage for some of the insurgent leaders who may want to talk peace. He said that he would guarantee the safety of Mullah Mohammed Omar if he was prepared to negotiate. Some people on that side are saying we can't negotiate unless all foreign troops leave Afghanistan. Is there a possibility that there could be negotiations? Is that precondition something that is set in stone, that foreign troops have to leave? What would be in the interest of the Taliban to sit down with Karzai?
Well, the thing is that there has already been a lot of that going on. And in fact, members of the original Taliban who never really felt themselves to be a part of the kind of al-Qaeda network during the 90s and early 2000s, have some of them notably and others more quietly come back to Afghanistan and have left their association with the al-Qaeda Taliban network. So that's not just something that's brand new to the political environment there. But this article is referring to really is the kind of thing that we started out essentially the program with when we're talking about what happened to the various parts of Afghanistan as Afghanistan's trying to reestablish itself as a viable, stable, a secure nation state. It has to go out, the central government does, and those helping it to, make sure that all of the regions of Afghanistan feel like they, too, are a part of this development. And right now, that eastern, southeastern area of Afghanistan is where there is not that sense of belonging that has historical as well as economic reasons for that. And I think what Karzai is trying to do is to promote a more active dialogue to try and attach some of those people to the government. I don't think that Mullah Mohammed Omar would be welcomed back by many Afghans, to be frank. I think, ultimately President Karzai is going to have to. That would be a major challenge because many in the of his northern allies, and he has numbers of those colleagues or coalitions that he's put together, plus just the population that suffered greatly at the hands of Taliban ethnic cleansing, would have great difficulty dealing with the return of somebody like Mullah Mohammed Omar or Gulbuddin Hikmet Yar. Jalaluddin Haqqani as well. And again, you got to remember, like the whole Hazara population of Afghanistan, which currently, through the leadership of Karim Khalili, is one of the members of the Karzai coalition. That central part of Afghanistan suffered greatly through the ethnic cleansing. Plus, it had the destruction of these nearly 2,000-year-old Buddhist statues, which are Afghanistan's most prized tourist and historical, treasures. And so people in that area are not going to be looking forward to a return of somebody like that. So that's a real challenge. Whether or not President Karzai is trying to use this as a way to encourage others to come, I don't know. I have to think that he knows that the return of Mullah Muhammad Omar would create more problems for him probably than it would solve.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Dennis from Appleton. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a quick question. I've been hearing on some of the news networks that General Petraeus might be asked to be Secretary of State. And I was just kind of wondering what you thought, what thoughts he had on that, and how much truth there might be to it. That's pretty much it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I think it's highly unlikely that the Obama administration would be asking to lead its foreign policy initiatives an individual who was associated primarily with the administration or the implementation of a policy in Iraq that with which Obama and many others disagreed. I think Obama values the military qualities and capacities of an individual like Petraeus, and I think it more likely that he would suggest to any person who's going to be assigned the duty or picked to be the Secretary of Defense that let's stick with this guy now that he is in charge of the overall region and is in charge, therefore, also of the programs that need to be applied in Afghanistan militarily. Let's at least keep him for a period of transition or maybe even further to see if he can apply the successes that he had, the experiences that he had in the Iraq situation to Afghanistan. I caution people, however, to be aware that, Iraq and Afghanistan are two very different places with two very different types of security environments. And so just having had been successful in Iraq doesn't necessarily, suggest that there will be success in Afghanistan by following a similar policy. I think Petraeus is smart enough to know that he's going to have to deal with Afghanistan in its own, in its own environment, in its own way.
We go next to Wes, and we're running short on time, everybody, from Madison. Hi, Wes.
Hi.
Hi.
There was one thing I was really curious if your guest could do for us, which is to just kind of give us a little bit of a sketch of what life is like on the ground for actual Afghanis living in the hills in the different parts of the country, what the infrastructure is like. Do they have cars? Like, what life is like actually like for Afghanis, and how that has been affected by the American presence there and by the Taliban presence, and I'll take my comments off.
Thanks, Wes. About a minute and a half.
Okay, that's a question that I'm speaking to a lot recently. I talk about the fact that, unfortunately, right now, the U.S. approach is losing average Joe Afghan. The average Joe Afghan, is predisposed in favor of the United States. 90-some percent of the population wanted us to come in. They knew that their whole future was dependent upon a massive, injection of American interest and support. And because of the lack of success of our reconstruction programs, lack of coordination for reasons I mentioned earlier, the Afghan lifestyle, the quality of life, hasn't met the expectations of what the Afghans thought Americans can do. There's still major sanitation problems. The the great bowl in which Kabul is located. When I went there first in 1964, 260,000 people. Today, 6 million people. Not enough water, not enough hydroelectric power, which is the source of all of Afghanistan's power. And so you have water shortages, you have energy shortages, you have gridlock because there's so many internationals in Kabul because they can't go to the provinces to do their projects because of the security issues. And so there's gridlock of personnel, actual physical gridlock of motor vehicles, and there's programmatic gridlock. So things are better than they were at 9/11 and immediately thereafter. But the expectations of the Afghans are not being met, and we need to be focusing more on programs that focus on the life of the average Afghan rather than on big spin projects that we focused on in the past.
Thank you so much for being with us. You're a wonderful guest, Tom. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathleen. I enjoy having the opportunity to do this from time to time on the Wisconsin Public Radio.
Great. We'll invite you again. Thomas Gutierrez, Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and the Medical Center as well. He was a Peace Corps volunteer in Afghanistan and spent 10 years living in the country. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Tretter for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We will hear the news and return for another hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.